Dr. Ketchko.
Thank you, Will. I'm very happy to join you on this program. I almost ended up here in Fairbanks about 8 years ago, I think, on a generally similar program. But I went one way and my right leg went the other while I was playing tennis. I popped the remaining cartilages in my leg and ended up in the hospital instead. I'm reminded of that by virtue of the fact that I managed to sneak out of what might otherwise have been some dull responsibilities yesterday and chase ptarmigan over about 15 miles of your beautiful country, and it's magnificent. Let me try to pay it back in some way by giving you, to a large extent, some of the conclusions of a book that Giulio Pontecorvo and I have recently finished and published with the kind help of Joe Fisher and his boys at RFF. Since they financed the project, they'll be glad to satisfy your curiosity at $6 a throw, if you're interested in so doing. It is not, incidentally, and I'd like to make this clear at the outset, an attack on fishery scientists or fishery science as such. Quite the contrary. I've been impressed more and more deeply, not only as a member of the mafia that is turned out by the University of Washington College of Fisheries and now extends its tentacles all over the world, but also by the developing experience in the Alaska fisheries themselves, that after a very long period of time and an increasingly intensive effort by federal, state, industry, university researchers, we are beginning to learn enough about our salmon so that in physical terms, the possibility of reversing the trends downward that have been so evident over the last 20 or 30 years may well be not only within our grasp, but beginning to show some statistical tales that are most encouraging. But the book and my discussion tonight do represent an attack on faulty concepts, both in terms of objectives and techniques of fishery management, which for practical purposes have robbed both the fishing industry and the public of the opportunity to benefit from what fishery science has to offer now and will have to offer in the future. In effect, I think we're facing a sort of economic Malthusianism in which the best that can be hoped of the present environment, if we do succeed in rebuilding salmon stocks slowly, painfully, and at some sacrifice, is that we'll end up with more poor fishermen, more severe restrictions on anybody who has the audacity to try to use efficient gear, more difficulties for the poor scoundrel who's charged with management and enforcement of regulations, which are patently not sensible to the individual fisherman. And it's not a pleasant prospect. Let me point out, in perhaps different words than Sal used, and in some respects different words than Hiroshi Kasahara was using, what seemed to me the essential economic issues involved in our controversy over what salmon management has been and ought to be. The case of a renewable resource like salmon, there are two requirements that have to be met before it can make its major contribution, its optimal contribution, to the welfare of the people who exploit it and use its products. One is to avoid waste through a faulty time distribution of the catch, which is our jargon way of saying, don't catch all of them too soon. There is a functional link between today's fishing effort and that available in the future. Secondly, and equally important, we've got to avoid waste through excessive capital and labor used to take any given level of catch, or improper combinations of capital and labor, which is a polite way of saying every time something in the way of a new technological dodge appears, it's promptly legislated out of existence, lest it pose a threat to the viability of the stocks themselves. The salmon industry, I think, represents the classic illustration of the kind of development that you get under any open access or common property fishery. This has been beaten to death for most of you over many, many papers and many volumes. I'm not going to repeat the argument at this point, other than to make what seem to me the two principal points that have to be made clear. The most important by far is that as long as anyone is free to enter a fishery, particularly a fishery in which the price of the product relative to the cost of producing it is very favorable, there is no possible way in which a single fisherman or any group of fishermen can make the essential link that needs to be made between the impact of today's catch and the opportunities that will be available to him in succeeding cycle years. Even if he is aware of the fact that by restricting catch today to allow more adequate escapement, more would be available 2, 3, 4, or 5 years hence. If he withholds effort in this year's fishery, he simply passes it along to the next guy. A less obvious, but in some respects more disturbing conclusion is that anything that improves the price of the product, whether it be population growth, income growth, improvements in marketing and packaging and the like, that reflects a more attractive price for fishermen, simply guarantees that the process of excessive fishing effort, overextensive development of the resource, will proceed more rapidly. There is gain neither to the industry nor to the consuming public. The thing then that emerges is that the causes of overfishing are essentially an economic phenomenon. It comes about because of a fairly simple at least to define, flaw in the mechanism that makes a private enterprise economy the magnificently flexible and adaptable instrument that it is, in most respects. And that is that the guy who uses resources must either own them or control them in a way that gives him a financial incentive to use them efficiently. But if he has no property right in a fishery resource today, and even less a property right in the fishery resources that will be available tomorrow and the tomorrow after that, the essential link is broken. He treats the resource as if tomorrow it would be worth nothing, because to him, that's exactly the situation that prevails. I stress this sort of now commonplace analysis because it seemed to Julio and myself, my co-author and myself, when we were reading about the history of salmon in Alaska, that we were looking at an entirely different kind of explanation of what had gone wrong in the industry, a sort of dirty bastard theory of the salmon industry. Each guy had his own particular candidate. Sometimes it was inept federal administration. Sometimes it was the absentee owner. Sometimes it was the gill netter who fought with the purse seiner, or the resident fisherman versus the non-resident fisherman. The point I think to be stressed and stressed most strongly is that while everybody may have shared some of the guilt at some time, what happened to the Alaska fisheries would have happened at the hands of different people with different names, maybe using different kinds of gear, whether the fishery had been subject to territorial rather than federal control, whether local rather than absentee ownership of some of the instruments had prevailed. It doesn't do much good now to point to the sins of the past. I think the essential point to be made is that it was a structural flaw in the arrangements under which private enterprise harvests the salmon that gave us our basic problem. And it is to correct that flaw that fishery management must somehow be directed. The objectives then that seem sensible, as Sal was pointing out, to an economist, involve all of the raw material that the fishery scientist can make available to us. We must know what the links are between the level and composition of fishing effort and what can be sustained over time. These are the alternatives that we want to evaluate. We want to know, in brief and in somewhat rough terms, what the right level of catch on the average might be. But we are also equally interested in something which a conservation program geared purely to maximum sustained physical yield does not deal with and cannot deal with. And that is the fact that it makes a whacking big difference how you take that particular level of catch. It can be taken efficiently or inefficiently. From the standpoint of a regulatory program geared only to physical yield, it makes no difference which of these choices you make. And in the hard, practical world of salmon politics, and I don't know any tougher or harder world, this generally adds up to limiting the most efficient gear, limiting the latecomer, and putting the blocks to the guy farthest away from the operation, if you're able to do so politically. The result then has been, in some cases directly, in some cases inadvertently, a pattern of salmon regulation which saw one part of the objective very clearly, the complexity of the combination short and long run relationships that determine the productivity of these interlaced salmon stocks. And over time, I think, has done a pretty fair job of delineating what we can do and what we can't do within tolerable ranges. But it has never even faced the problem of how to devise methods of keeping fishing mortality at desired levels that will permit efficient harvesting today and that will provide some incentive to people to find even more efficient techniques in the future. Quite the contrary. And I think this is really the basic root of our problem. The desired result that I think we would want to look for from a resource like the Pacific salmon, Alaska salmon in particular, is the sort of result that we expect under any mature, natural resource-oriented industry. Once we have reached biological limits on physical production, forgetting for the moment the complications in defining, we would expect over time, under a really good management program, to achieve steadily increasing incomes to our fishermen. Salmon is a highly desirable product, well up into the luxury class in most respects. Demand for it responds very rapidly to changes in real incomes, and it responds, obviously, to changes in population. Against the background, then, of a rising demand, we would expect that our stabilized salmon industry would yield larger and larger returns to the packer, the fisherman, and, under a sensible arrangement, to the state itself as the landlord of the basic resource. We'd expect also that an industry managed along these lines would develop greater, not lesser, ability to withstand the shocks that you're inevitably going to face with a highly erratic physical supply problem from year to year, and to some extent a pretty erratic market problem on a year-to-year basis. We would expect to find that the industry, as it stabilized out but saw steady increases in demand and price, to be able and willing to provide the budgetary muscle for an expanded research and management and enforcement program, an expansion that would be justified as the resource itself becomes more valuable and more intensively utilized over time. That's a pretty picture, but it isn't exactly what's happened. And I don't think I need elaborate in detail to an audience of this sort just how far we deviate from this pattern of an efficiently exploited, stabilized natural resource industry. We've reduced fishing mortality not sufficiently, since no amount of talk can blink away the fact that we are using, by rough calculation, and it has to be rough because of the changes in gear involved, something between 2 and 2.5 times the amount of labor and capital that we used pre-war to catch something like 60 or 70% as many fish. And there just isn't any other explanation. We cannot point to pollution. We cannot point to the Japanese fishing on the high seas for more than a relatively small part of that. We cannot point to unwise land utilization that lops off spawning streams, as we find in Oregon and Washington, to some extent in British Columbia. It's pretty hard to argue the fact that even in a physical sense, our conservation program has fallen far short of what could have been accomplished. Again, I hasten to add that this, I think and believe, has been reversed. But the salmon being the kind of an animal it is, by the time 6 or 8 cycles have gone by to show the full benefits of that, the cost has amounted to a pretty substantial one. There's been a lot of talk and no action about the obvious, glaring problem of the industry, that more and more people are vigorously engaged in picking fish out of one another's pockets. They are not only adding nothing to total catch, they are making the problem of management far more difficult. They bring to bear political pressures that make it impossible even to use the management tools we have as efficiently as we know how. We have tolerated a substantial amount of economic waste, and we tolerate along with it a kind of confusion as to objective that has made conservation, or salmon management if you like, and low-grade politics almost synonyms for one another. This again is not a bad man theory. What else could you do in the face of a situation of that sort? Part of the effort then in the book went to answer the question, how bad is the waste? If it's a matter of 10 or 15 or 20%, something of this order, perhaps it isn't even worth worrying about. Salmon management at best is a costly, difficult proposition. And salmon management geared to a drastically changed view of how we ought to manage the resource involves political costs, it involves social readjustments of considerable magnitude. Unless there's something really substantial at issue then, it may well be not worth the trouble to take the effort. We took a look at it then in a number of areas, and I'd like to sketch in for you very briefly one of the areas that seem most interesting, the Bristol Bay fishery. It was a little easier to ask and answer, at least roughly, the question, how much are we really wasting in the kind of industry and management program we have in Bristol, for a couple of obvious reasons. One, the mix of gear is relatively simple. Two, it has been subject to increasingly intensive scientific and management efforts so that we have a fairly good statistical background of the industry. Third, and most important, we have a kind of rough benchmark for the Bristol Bay fishery that's entirely lacking in any others available to it. Because we had a 2-year period, 1942 and 43, when for reasons entirely unrelated to the fishery, which are familiar to all of you, it was necessary to reduce the amount of fishing effort drastically and to pull the fishery tight inshore, which would not have been possible earlier. What we did then was to take a look at what amounts of gear would have been required, first on the assumption of no change in gear efficiency or technology at all, if the catch rates that prevailed in the war years of 42-43 per operating unit had in fact allowed to prevail in subsequent years. Even on this extremely conservative assumption, nay, A, that the level in 42-43 was actually as low as it could have been to catch the available harvest, which is subject to some question, and B, the assumption that over 25 years you wouldn't have devised some better techniques and some more efficient organization of the labor force in the industry. Even on those very substantially conservative assumptions, the numbers come out something like this. The amount of excess gear in the Bristol Bay fishery in the last 5 to 10 years is probably in the neighborhood of 65% to 75%. Translated into dollars, it means that we are wasting something in the neighborhood of $2 to $3 million annually. Not by reference to traps which are politically unacceptable in Alaska, or to some kind of technology yet to be developed, just in terms of simple gill nets, but the right number of them placed appropriately. If you make the further assumption that over the 25-year period, the shift to power, the use of monofilament nylon, a few other techniques that might be permitted, the number jumps to something like $3 to $3.5 million annually that could be saved with not only complete safety to the viability of the stocks as we have now, but probably with considerably easier management and certainly considerably easier enforcement of the regulations that we have. We've not been able, or were not able, to take the time to extend this kind of analysis to the rest of the Alaska salmon fisheries. It's been suggested by the members of the study team working on this present project here at the university that we might take at least a flyer at it by simply taking the years in which we had the highest catch per unit of gear in the water and taking that as a benchmark, see what would have happened in all other years if catch rates had gone at that level. It's a pretty crude way of going at it, but I suspect that the numbers would come up somewhere in the vicinity of perhaps $15 to $20 million annually for the Alaska industry as a whole. By comparison, a very detailed study of the amount of excess and completely wasted gear in the Sacramento River fishery, which is not small potatoes, it's a $4 million, $3.5 million a year fishery, was about 93%. It would take about 30 to 35 gill nets operating properly in that fishery to harvest everything that could be taken. And that would represent less than 10% of the gear now actually employed. Columbia River might well be even less than that, at least in certain stretches of it. The future implications of that, I think, speak for themselves. We're facing two changes, both of which give even greater importance to the need for framing regulations that enable us gradually and over an appropriate time period to reduce excess gear to the point where at least part of that potential gain can be realized. One is the progress in fishery science and management techniques themselves, which I think offer a lot of promise for expanding the physical output of the Alaska salmon industry, at least well along toward the levels that were reached in the peak 15 or 20 year period back in the 20s and 30s. And secondly, there can be, I think, no arguing the fact that the total output of the salmon industry cannot be expanded as rapidly as the demand for high-quality fishery products of this sort. Consequently, the dollars wasted are getting bigger and bigger all the time. And unless this sort of regulatory approach is adopted, the number of men who can divide up the salmon catch and still make a living is going to get bigger and not smaller. And the individual salmon fisherman is still going to limp along on lower incomes than could easily be made available, using gear which he knows to be inefficient compared to what he could use, and griping his head off about it. politically and sometimes effectively politically. Again, I'd like to stress in closing one perhaps more serious point. We took a look at a localized fishery, a very valuable and important one from the standpoint of a West Coaster, but still in world terms, a relatively small and isolated case. But we've now had case studies of a fairly significant number of fisheries in the United States and throughout the world. Each of them has shown the same pattern of early rapid development, a maturing that is followed by a collapse in both physical output and economic earnings, and then at best, a long, slow, painful rebuilding to part of the level that could have been achieved in the first place if we'd anticipated it properly. If nothing else, then, the experience of the salmon industry suggests that we ought to do a hell of a lot better in framing an institutional arrangement in which newly developing fisheries on shellfish, perhaps at some later date on bottom fish, can actually be developed. Failure to do that is going to mean that the salmon, the halibut, more recently the king crab experiences are going to be repeated again and again, and that the industry capable of producing some of the most valuable and marketable species of seafood in the world will continue to fail the obligation it has to the people of this state. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.